The book of Isaiah has a twofold message, condemnation and consolation. And in chapters 1 through 12, it is devoted mostly to condemnation. The chapter 5 that I'm going to be discussing this morning is right in the center of condemnation. And I'm sure there are those that think that I am in my element in chapter 5. I remember one time visiting with Brother Bill Koss up in Chicago. And I was in the middle of a big fight over doctrine, as usual. And I looked up at him and I said, "Bill, I hate what I do." And that's a fact, brethren. There are people that think I love a fight. The only time that I love a fight is when Ollie and what's his name are getting their brains beat out. I really enjoy. Well, let me say it this way. I don't like to see people get hurt. But if there is a fight, I don't want to miss it. Provided I'm not on one side. In chapter 5, we have a parable to start with, the first several verses, a parable of the vineyard, wherein God shows one kind, he had sowed one kind of grape, but those folks had brought forth another kind, a wild grape. Then after that section is over, you come to the rest of that particular chapter, and you have the sins of Judah and Jerusalem, their lack of knowledge, the woes coming on the wicked, the wrath of Jehovah, and his call on the nations to come execute his wrath. In the parable of the vineyard, verses 1 through 7, he refers to someone he calls the well-beloved. Now, I want you to know that Jerry and I are good friends, and that anything I may say that's not quite according to the way he wrote it in the book, you must forgive him. I am studying that word well-beloved as to who was the speaker. He says, "My well-beloved hath a vineyard." It seems to me, personally, that the speaker here is Isaiah, and that he's referring to God as the well-beloved. Then he says in verse 2, "And he fenced it and gathered out the stones and planted it with the choicest vine and built a tower in the midst of it and also made a wine press therein. And he looked that it had should bring forth fruit, and it brought forth wild grapes." Now, if you had been God and you were planting a vineyard and you wanted the best kind of fruit to come and the thing brought forth wild grapes, how would you feel? I have known a few people in this world that sowed one thing and they thought they didn't get quite what they sowed. My wife is like that. She goes to get a certain kind of tree, and she plants it, and it comes up another kind from what she thought she planted. Or she'll get some of these azaleas, and they're supposed to bring forth these lovely flowers, and only one of those brought forth those beautiful flowers, and all the rest just kind of, well, they just didn't know which way. But here God was, and he was disappointed entirely with these people that had brought forth wild grapes. Then it talks about the song to my beloved. This concerns Jehovah having planted a vineyard. Everything about the vineyard was conducive to a beautiful harvest. As I consider the things that God has given us, especially in the New Testament, He brought the finest one to be sacrificed that there ever could possibly be, his only begotten son, into this world. And his son came in and gave us a life that was exemplary in every way. He gave a life that was so perfect that there was not even one sin to be lodged against him. And after he had shown how to live and had taught us what to believe and how to live, then finally he poured out his precious blood. And then on that third day we see him rising to give the whole world hope of a resurrection. And we see thus that God has prepared a great vineyard in our day. And wouldn't it be terrible if we all brought forth wild grapes? I am of the persuasion that we do not recognize that God has feelings. I know that he's called our Heavenly Father. And we talk about our beloved and merciful Heavenly Father, but because he's a spirit and not flesh and blood as you and I have, many times I think we do not realize that he has feelings too. And that if he was planting such a vineyard as we now have in this world, that it would be a tremendous disappointment if we did not bring forth the kind of grapes that he planted. In verse 1, it also says that he planted this vineyard in a very fruitful hill. Many years ago, there were people from Europe that were vineyard keepers in Europe, and they came to this country and they brought plants to this country from the finest vineyards that there were in France, especially in France, and perhaps in other countries. And they went across this whole nation of ours in covered wagons, and they protected those plants until they got all the way to California, because in the Napa Valley of California is the best place for such plants to grow and to bring forth the kind of grapes that would produce the kind of wine that they were trying to produce. Would it not have been a terrible disappointment to all those people to have gone into the Napa Valley and after having gone to all that trouble to bring those plants from Europe to this country and all across this country, even in covered wagons, and then finally, after having planted them, to bring forth wild grapes? Brethren, if you can think of that, then you can understand a little better, perhaps, the feelings in Jehovah. He did everything to bring forth a good crop, a good harvest. He not only planted it in what's called a fruitful hill, just like those vintners that had gone into California. They had sought the very best land. And so God planted Jerusalem and Judea in a very fruitful hill, the finest kind of soil. So it was off to a good start right there. He gathered out the stones. Now, many of us in this country where we don't have stones in our area may find that not too convincing as to what's being said. Those of us that have been into the land of Palestine and have seen all those stones in all those lands, how many of you have ever been in that part? Raise your hand a little higher. Ooh, you are a traveling bunch. But you remember the stones, don't you? Everywhere, stones, stones. And before you can really plant and expect a harvest, you've got to gather out the stones. And so God had gathered out the stones. He planted the choicest vines. He built a tower in their midst. Oh, a tower, what's that for? Well, you've got to watch for people coming in to do mischief or animals destroying your vines, and so you build a tower to show that he really intended to get a good harvest. He even built a wine press and anticipated wonderful grapes. And what did he get? Wild grapes. So Jehovah calls upon Jerusalem and Judah to judge, what more could he have done? Verses 3 and 4. Well, if they were at all reasonable, they should have realized that he had done everything possible to bring forth the kind of fruit that he had in mind. And here they were, they had perverted and thwarted his will. And he purposed to desolate them for it. We read in the 23rd chapter of Matthew, verses 37, 38, Jesus Christ had a very similar thing to say of Jerusalem. When he said, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stone them that come unto thee. And then he tells them that he would have gathered them like a chicken gathers her chicks under her wings, but you would not. Therefore, your house is left unto you desolate. When God does everything he can for us and then tells us what his will is, and then we still won't do it, we become the wild grapes, and he will have none of us. When he leaves our house desolate, it will be desolate indeed. Now, in verse 7, he identifies that the vineyard of the Lord is, first of all, the house of Israel. And secondly, the house of Judah, which he calls his pleasant plant. God looked for judgment and got oppression. He looked for righteousness and had to listen to the wail of the righteous as they were being downtrodden. Well, with this parable of the vineyard in the background to shed light on the rest of the chapter, beginning with verse 8 down to the end of the chapter, verse 30, we have all of these things put into perspective. First of all, in verses 8 through 12, he takes up the sins of Jerusalem and Judah. They were not content with their reasonable possessions. They had to have everything. And so they had their own land, and then they wanted the land next to it, and then the next to it on that side, and then the land next to that. We have a man in Memphis that has built a house. Now, I like that house. It is a gorgeous house. My wife despises that house. And she and I take her by there once a week so she can look at it, hoping to improve her appreciation of the finer things. But this fella had an idea about a house that, to me, showed a lot of initiative. Now, if any of you have been to Memphis, you may have seen the house that I'm talking about. And if you haven't, next time you come, you ask me and I'll take you. But this man's neighbors got to worrying him because they didn't like the house either. I don't know what they knew about it. But they didn't like it, and so they began to complain. And you know what he did? He bought them out on both sides. He bought their houses so he wouldn't have to listen to their complaint. Well, I don't think that's what Judah and Jerusalem did. I think they just greedy. They just lusted. They coveted property. And they just could never get enough. And so they were laying land to land. For this cause, God warned them, verses 9 and 10, that though they had coveted it, they were going to lose it all. And he said that their mansions would be desolate, their vineyards and fields would be non-productive. Did they need all that land? Well, of course not. You can only use so much land. Sometimes people that are trying to win everything in this life need to stop and consider how little we really need. I found out how little I needed in 1940. We went down into a place called Mercedes, Texas. I was preaching down there. And the only people in the congregation that had jobs that paid left one day because they couldn't have their way. And that left only the poor. Brethren, I've never lived in a congregation that was so poor as the ones they left behind, because the others didn't have any jobs. And what little work they did, they couldn't get any money. And I found out that I could get by on so little. One person said, "Well, you can eat with me once a day." I said, "Okay." Another one said, "You eat with me once a day." "All right." Another one said, "Well, I don't like what I eat myself, but if you can stand it, you can eat with me." "All right." One said, "I don't have any extra food," but he said, "I do have an extra bed, and you can sleep in it." And I remember Joe Bailey spoke up and said, "Well, you can't have my bed." He said, "I've only got one, and it's a single bed, and my wife and I sleep in it, and you're not welcome." But he said, "I'm a barber," and he said, "You come by my barber shop, and I will cut your hair once a week." That's, brethren, that was once a week. And so I said, "Well, what does a man in this world really need? If he's got 3 meals a day and a place to sleep and a haircut, how much more does he really need?" But so many times we want everything. Not only what we've got that we need, and then we want to get what we've got that we don't need, and then we want yours too. I do recall, as our children were growing up, the one word, the one group of words that I recall that our children always said, and it was nearly every day, and nearly every meal, "Don't eat it all up." And there they were, had plenty on their plate, and they were afraid that somebody else going to eat it all up, even though they already had plenty on their plate. Ah. You ever see that in your family? Most families have that same problem. Well, so instead of evangelizing the world in our day, what are we doing? Well, in most instances, we squander millions upon millions of dollars on other things that we did not really need. For many years, I have tried to get our people to evangelize this entire world. And brethren, we've got the wherewithal to do it. We've got it. But if we don't apply it, it won't get done. I will always remember riding back to this city, Houston. And a brother said, "Well," I was trying to get him to help on something. And he said, "Well, we just can't afford it." He said, "We just don't have it." And when I got back to Houston, I found him with all that white carpet on his floors and everything plush, wall to wall, driving the finest car, and he couldn't help. Brethren, I don't believe that. I think we're a bunch of liars in the churches of Christ. I think we are the biggest bunch of hypocrites that there is upon the face of God's earth. I think we're a bunch of wild grapes when we say we can't do it and we've got everything under the sun. When they begin to build these so-called family life centers, Buster, family life centers, it would be much easier to call them what they are, gymnasiums. But when we started doing all that, what was that for? Was that to evangelize this world? No, it was to exercise our own pleasure, wasn't it? Isn't that what it was? What it still is? How much does one of those cost? You can't hardly get one for under $500,000. And others may go up to $1 million or more. That money that we could have used in supporting people to go out into the world to evangelize, how many of those do you suppose there are in this brotherhood? Every last one of them should never have happened. And every last one of them, all that money, we know that they could have get it because they got it. If that money had been used to evangelize the world, brethren, we would have been able to have done far more than we ever have. I'll be honest with you, brethren, I think this building is about right. I don't see anything too extraordinarily plush about it. Of course, I do see you're sitting on soft seats, but some of us need that, you know. I don't really begrudge that.
But when I see people, when I see brethren just squandering what we have to have the finest building, and they do it to fulfill the lust of their eye, and to fulfill the pride of their life. They take pride in it, brethren. What about it? Is that going to be all right? Well, because they were living in pleasure, they had no knowledge. You know, when you spend all of your time in pleasure, you're not going to have time to study. And when they do study, it's study to have more pleasure. But these people, because of living for their own pleasure, were without knowledge. Without knowledge, we do not know how to live. And we cannot compete with our neighbors. We therefore can be led captivity by others. There are people that are thronging into eternity as were theirs, unprepared to meet God, verses 14 to 15. But in verse 16, it was God's will that he be exalted and that he be sanctified, and not that we just use everything upon our own pleasure. It talks about the lambs feeding after their manner. I don't know exactly what that means, but I do know that I have been in places where lambs eat, and they eat the grass clear down to the ground. Brethren, when they, after their manner is, there's nothing left for anybody else after they get through eating. But then I got to thinking about Laodicea. In 1961, my wife and family and I, together with others, went into the Bible lands, and we were trying to find Laodicea. And I drove, and man, where I thought it was, I drove and I drove and I drove, and I couldn't find it. And then, as I was driving along, I saw kind of a, seemed like the earth kind of rose up. It wasn't exactly a hill, but it kind of rose up a bit. And so I thought, I believe I'll just stop the car and go over above that rise and see what's over there. And you know what I found? Laodicea. And you know what was there? They had all this huge, huge stadium that they had built. Bigger than our stadium, most of our stadiums. And it had this great field down in the bottom. One time that stadium was used for everything under the sun, the way of pleasure. And I looked, and the bottom of the stadium was sowed to wheat. And I looked all around, and listen, they had running water in Laodicea. They had steam heat in Laodicea. You and I think, man, they couldn't have had that in those days. They did. And the only person I saw in all that ancient, lovely, rich city was a little shepherd boy guarding his sheep while they ate everything down to the ground. Brethren, if it's going to be like that, where everything's just eaten up, then what? Well, he talks about the woes that are to be pronounced upon the wicked, verses 18 to 23. Jerusalem and Judea were bound to their iniquity as with cords, and to their sins as with a cart rope. Their concerns were not what did God want, but it's called vanity. In other words, they were concerned about vain things. And vain just means empty, void, meaningless, powerless, worthless. But that's what they were tied to. And because the Lord did not judge them speedily, they thought that they could just do that forever. They'd get by, like just you and I. You think sometimes that hasn't happened yet. Maybe we can get by. But it's not going to be forever, because there is appointed a day. They perverted God's principles, putting everything in reverse. Look at verse 20. Let's just read that a moment. Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Does that remind you of anyone that you know of in the state of Texas? How about over here in San Antonio? We've got a man over there that has turned himself into an idol, and he is idolized by thousands and many thousands among our brethren, but he's turned everything in reverse. Brethren, that's what these people had done. They had perverted the principles of God. Professing themselves to be wise, they had become fools. We read also about that in Romans 1:22. They were proud of their own strength, and yet they were dissipating it with strong drink. Verse 22. Bribery perverted their judgment. Verse 23. Also, if you'll read in Exodus 23:7-8, Proverbs 17:15, and compare, you will see that when you take bribes, it affects your judgment. Verses 24-25, we take up the anger of the Lord. They had cast away the law. They didn't want it. They despised his word. They didn't want it. As I sat there all this week, listening to all this wonderful speaking and preaching from the Word of God, I thought to myself, what is there about this that does not attract the appreciation of those among us that have gone into what we call liberalism? What is it? Because it's the richest kind of preaching that you can have. It looks like they would appreciate it. It looks like they would want it. And yet they despise it and cast it away. Same thing today as was in the day of Jerusalem and Judah with Isaiah. Well, what's going to happen? God will smite them with punishment. Well, is it going to be just for a short time? Apparently not. It's apparent that he is not going to be appeased. For in the end of verse 25, for all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. Sometimes people think that stretched out means it's stretched out this way. But if you read verses 24 and 25, it's stretched out this way. And his anger will not be assuaged. Once he decides he's going to destroy you, you're going to be destroyed. Once he decides to punish you or me, we are going to be punished. Well, how was he going to punish them? He was going to use the nations round about to execute his wrath. First of all, he was going to lift up an ensign. What is an ensign? Well, it's a battle flag. And when our people go into battle, they raise a flag and they go. We sometimes sing that song, and there's an ensign raised up today, marching on, marching on. We sing that song and not a clue as to what that ensign means, but that's what it is. So God is going to raise up a battle flag, and he's going to call upon the nations. The word he uses is hiss. And how could that be a hiss? Well, I think probably Jerry may have that about right. The hiss of a beekeeper, as I understand it, that they can use a certain hiss and cause the bees to come out of the hive and to cluster upon the ground. And so, when God hisses to the nations and they come from all quarters against Jerusalem and Judah, they're following the sound of his hiss to accomplish his vengeance speedily. The nations will come, and there won't be any way to keep them from coming. It will be inexorable. They will come without let up or pause. They won't stop to rest or sleep, or even to change clothes or take off their shoes. And brethren, when they come at you like that, you're going to get it. And their attack was to be on that score. They won't stop. They will come. And when they come, verse 20-28 shows that they will be ready to fight. Let's read that. Whose arrows are sharp and all their bows bent, their horses' hooves shall be counted like flint, and their wheels like a whirlwind. They will be ready to fight, and there won't be any way to prevent them from bringing their battle against Jerusalem and Judah. Their terror shall be like the roaring of the sea. Verse 30. Their vengeance, this vengeance, will be complete. All will be darkness and sorrow. Even the light will be darkness. Have you ever been in darkness when it just seemed like there was no light at all? Well, what if even the light that there is turned into darkness? Brethren, that's darkness. And that's the way it was to be with Jerusalem and Judah. What about us? The day will come, brethren, when we all are going to stand to be judged according to the deeds done in our bodies, whether good or bad. In John, the 15th chapter, verses 1 to 8, we find that branches that bear no fruit are hewn down and cast into the fire. Judah and Jerusalem, being planted as a vineyard by the Lord, had brought forth evil fruit. And now look what they had to look forward to. And we know the story, what did take place later. It did happen. And brethren, it will happen likewise to us if we bear no fruit. How many of us today live only for ourselves? As a young preacher, I think back somewhat shamefacedly, I think I did live a lot for myself. I came to your city of Houston in 1939 and was leading the singing in a gospel meeting for Robert R. Price, and his daughter-in-law, Dora B. Price, is sitting right there by my wife, that handsome lady. And Brother Robert R. Price and I held that gospel meeting, and Brother John O'Dowd was the preacher there. And he saw how much I put in the contribution that Lord's Day. And after it was over, he came to me and said, "Brother Ira, how much did you put in the contribution today?" I says, "None of your business." He said, "I'm my brother's keeper. How much was it?" Well, I said, "It's none of your business, but it was 50 cents. He said, "How much did you make last week?" Well, I said, "You're kind of nosy, aren't you?" He said, "Don't get fresh with me, young man. How much did you make?" Well, I knew how much it was. I was averaging $37.50 a week in those days. That was good pay in those days. And I was earning it as a newspaper man down in the Rio Grande Valley, most of it. And I got a little extra for preaching on Sundays and Wednesday nights over at Ed Couch. Well, he said, "Well, man, you're going to bust hell wide open." I said, "What makes you think so?" And he took me there to the 5th chapter of Matthew, verse 20. And he said, "Except your righteousness exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, ye shall in no case enter the kingdom of heaven." I said, "How do you know that's not quality?" And he said, "How can you prove it's not quantity? Can you give a 10-cent piece? Can you hit the basket with a $20 thud, with a 10-cent piece? And because of the quality of your giving," that don't work, brethren. And he convinced me that day that I was going to have to do better than that. And so I took out a $5 bill and I threw it. And down. I said, take it. He said, no, it's got to be given cheerfully. And, brethren, that was the day I learned to give. I was doing things for my own comfort, my own convenience, my own pleasure. And on the way home, after my wife and I got off our honeymoon, the first problem we had to settle was how much to give. And I pulled over to the side and stopped the car, and I said, we got to get one thing straight right now. I think it scared her half to death. She said, what is it? I said, we've got to decide how much we're going to give. Well, she said, what do you think it ought to be? Well, I said, it's got to be more than the scribes and Pharisees. What I'm trying to get across to us all, brethren, is this, that God has planted us as a wonderful vineyard. He expects us to bring forth good fruit. Let us try to do our best to bring forth the kind of fruit that our Lord intended. And then on that day, instead of us having to be in that darkness, which is so dark that even the light is darkness, He will be able to say to us, well done, good and faithful servants. You have been faithful over a few things. I make you ruler over many. Thank you.